distinction of state law in admitting certain testimony. Then, in the memorandum, Eli explored an idea that had been suggested by Fortas. This was that Betts v. Brady might be injurious to the very principles of federalism on which it supposedly rested. "The court has said," he wrote, "that if we were to discard the Betts test, it would be guilty of an unwarranted federal intrusion into state control of its criminal procedure. Perhaps the vagueness of the rule can be used to turn this argument against its proponents." In other words, an absolute requirement of counsel might be less of an intrusion on state criminal processes because it would be clear-cut, in contrast to what Eli called the confusion of the special circumstances approach. "The nature of that approach," Eli said, "required state courts to guess in its application, and a wrong guess meant having to try the accused all over again later. Guessing was inevitable," he said, "because the Betts test was an amalgam of personal and retrospective factors. The trial judge could weigh such personal elements as the defendant's age, but elements such as the prosecutor's and judge's behavior could only be surveyed later." He said this amalgam ensures lack of success in application at any level. So long as judges are men, a trial court cannot foresee the progress of the trial, nor can an appellate court cull from a record on appeal a reliable picture of a man's abilities. Another weakness of the special circumstances rule, Eli continued in the July 25th memorandum, is that errors in its application stand little chance of being corrected, for it is unlikely that there are many convicts who, like Gideon, have the knowledge, ability, and ambition to institute an appeal, starting from the questionable assumption that there are on this earth laymen capable of adequately defending themselves against the accusations of the public prosecutor. The special circumstances rule, if it can be called a rule, is designed to sort out these fortunate and talented individuals. 20 years of confusion bear witness to its inadequacy. The next day, July 26th, Eli circulated a note on the distinction made as to the right to counsel in capital and non-capital cases. He said it made no sense in terms of need to have an automatic counsel requirement only when a possible death sentence was involved, since many non-capital charges were more complicated to defend against than murder. Crash had suggested the relevance of some recent Supreme Court decisions rejecting the capital-non-capital distinction in another area of the law. These were the court-martial cases, arising from a law providing for military trial of civilians accompanying the armed forces overseas. In 1957, the Supreme Court had held this law unconstitutional as applied to wives tried by courts-martial for killing their soldier husbands. A 6-2 majority, with Justice Clark writing a strong dissent, said the wives had been deprived of their right to trial by jury. Then in 1960, the court-martial problem came up in non-capital cases. Justices Frankfurter and Harlan wanted to draw the line at the murdering wives and permit civilians to be tried by military courts for non-capital offenses. But Justice Clark, now writing for the majority, said he could see no ground for the distinction and so held unconstitutional all military trials of civilians overseas. "Those cases," Eli said, "should be mentioned in our brief as an example of a realization of the inadequacy of a capital-non-capital distinction." But Eli said that no strong reliance should be placed on them because a different provision of the Constitution, the clause on regulating the armed forces, was involved. In yet another memorandum, Eli urged that no attempt be made to revive the contention that the 14th Amendment was intended to incorporate the original Bill of Rights intact. The argument had been decisively rejected, he said, and so the brief should follow the line that an assured right to counsel was fundamental, and so implicit in the guarantee of due process of law. A 10-page memorandum on July 31st discussed the companion clause of the 14th Amendment, that assuring the equal protection of the laws. The leading precedent here, as mentioned by Fitzpatrick, was Griffin v. Illinois, holding that a state denied equal protection when it required payment for trial records in order to appeal, thus excluding the poor. Eli noted this sentence from Justice Black's opinion. There can be no equal justice where the kind of trial a man gets depends on the amount of money he has. He was attracted by the opening that sentence seemed to provide. The argument from Griffin to Gideon is a simple one, he wrote, and in my opinion provides the court with a convenient method of overruling Betts without expressly contradicting its lengthy and explicit declaration that due process does not always demand appointment of counsel. A memorandum of August 3rd examined the transcript of Gideon's trial to see whether he had been prejudiced by lack of counsel. At first blush, Eli wrote, the transcript in State v. Gideon seems to present the very model of the myth of Betts, a case in which defense counsel is not needed. For the defendant exhibited remarkable skill in cross-examination, and the judge went to great lengths to inform him of his rights. But a closer look convinced Eli that Gideon's ability to defend himself was illusory. He pointed out numerous errors by the judge, examples of prejudice to Gideon, omissions. An argument could be made along the following lines, he concluded. Here is a trial in which the defendant was skillful and the judge made every effort to protect his rights. Yet even here, close examination of the law and of the facts reveals that defendant was repeatedly hurt by lack of counsel. If such prejudice occurred in this trial, it would seem that there is no trial in which counsel is unnecessary. Thus, the rule of Betts is based upon a false factual assumption. Here was a perception of Eli's that caught the eye of Abe Fortas, if indeed it had not previously occurred to him. Fortas combined it in his mind with the thesis that the special circumstances rule might actually result in more, not less, irritation to the states. I am convinced, Fortas explained later, that this judge in Panama City, Florida, tried to help Gideon defend himself. He just did a bad job, as any judge would. It's not a judge's role to be a defense counsel. He made mistakes. But how corrosive it is for federal-state relations to have a federal court tell that judge later that he did not do an adequate job. It was time now, in August, to see about printing the record of the case. When the Supreme Court agrees to hear a case, an abstract of the lower court proceedings is printed for the justice's convenience. The court's print shop does the actual printing, in brown-covered pamphlets that look rather like high-priced paperback books and sometimes run to many fat volumes. Ordinarily, the side that eventually loses the decision pays the printing cost, but in a pauper's case, such as Gideon's, the federal government pays if the prisoner loses. The process of compiling the record begins when the lawyer for the petitioner, Fortas in this case, submits to the clerk's office a designation of the material he thinks should be printed. The other side may then suggest additions or deletions. Printing the record in the Gideon case was not a routine matter, because there was a question what the record was. At that point, the only documents that were officially before the Supreme Court were Gideon's manuscript application for habeas corpus in the Florida Supreme Court and a few other fragmentary items. Since Gideon had begun an independent habeas corpus proceeding rather than appealing his conviction, the transcript of his trial was not technically before the court. Nevertheless, Fortas wanted to include it in the printed record. The transcript showed that this was the case in which to reconsider Betts v. Brady, he said later. If we didn't put the transcript in the record, Justice Harlan or someone might say, how can we pass on this grave constitutional question without even looking at the transcript? Hell, if I were on the Supreme Court, I wouldn't want to decide a question like this on a bare record. Fortas submitted a formal designation of record for printing that included the trial transcript. A copy, as required, went to the other side, the Florida Attorney General's office. On August 29th, Bruce R. Jacob of Florida filed a motion to strike from the printing designation the trial transcript. Matters which took place at the trial, which were not alleged in the petition for habeas corpus, the motion said, are not involved in the instant case and therefore have no place in the printed record. Inclusion of the trial papers in the printed record herein would be unnecessary and improper. Such inclusion would inject irrelevant matter into the instant case and would prejudice respondent in the presentation of his argument. Fortas replied, on September 13th, that the Supreme Court had ample power to supplement the technical record. Informed adjudication requires access to all relevant data, he said. Respondent would blind the court to information which may be of consequence in resolving the question framed by the court itself when granting certiorari. At the court, Chief Deputy Clerk Cullinan took the conflicting papers in hand and prepared them for submission to the court when it returned from the summer recess. He personally did not see why Fortas wanted the trial transcript in, since it showed Gideon as a rather shrewd defendant, fully participating in the trial. But then he did not know the approach that was taking shape in Fortas's mind. The court opened its new term on October 1st, and 2 weeks later it handed down a brief and unanimous order settling the dispute about the record in Gideon v. Cochran. Florida's motion was denied. The trial transcript was to be included. In about a week, the record was printed. Under the rules, the petitioner's, Gideon's, brief was due 30 days later. The party trying to upset the lower court ruling always goes first in briefing and arguing the case. His opponent has the benefit of examining his arguments before making his own. By then, Eli had gone back to school. In his place, an Arnold Fortas and Porter associate, Ralph Temple, with some help from another associate, Bruce Montgomery, looked into further questions posed by Crash and Fortas. October 25th, Temple to Crash. 5 pages on the history and contemporary picture of right to counsel in England. October 26th, Temple to Crash. A brief note on the large proportion of habeas corpus cases that stem from absence of counsel at trial. If counsel were required, this flood of prisoners' petitions in the federal courts should be reduced. October 26th, Temple to Crash. The growth of legal aid in the United States. Up to the year 1950, a total of $3,500,000 had been spent by public and private organizations to defend indigents in the criminal courts. In the next 10 years, $10,500,000 was spent. October 29th, Montgomery to Crash. A description of bills pending in Congress to provide public defenders and other organized means of representation for the poor in federal courts. October 31st, Montgomery to Crash. What is the right to counsel under Russian law? Answer, very little. November 1st. Montgomery to Crash. The right to counsel under Florida law. Appointment is specifically required only in capital cases, but judges have discretion to appoint in other cases, contradicting the same erroneous statement by the trial judge that Gideon had mentioned, and some trial judges in populous counties do so in all cases. November 8th, Crash to Fortas. You have asked if it is clear that Gideon v. Cochran is properly before the Supreme Court. It must be, because Gideon had followed exactly the same procedure as 2 other Florida prisoners who had recently won right-to-counsel cases in the Supreme Court. All along, Crash recognized, Fortas was less interested in abstract conceptual doctrines, such as the relation of the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, than he was in practical considerations, which he thought might really worry the justices. In a November memorandum, Crash addressed himself to these. Justice Roberts had been concerned in Betts v. Brady that an absolute requirement for provision of counsel might logically have to extend all the way down through traffic courts. Supporters of the Betts rule still made that argument, saying that the consequence would be an intolerable strain on the American legal system because there simply were not enough lawyers around to provide one for every traffic offender. Fortas did not shy away from that supposed horror. He did not think many persons charged with traffic and other minor offenses would want lawyers, but he was quite prepared to say that a poor traffic offender should be given a lawyer if he asked for one. Crash suggested a more conservative way to argue the Gideon case, which after all did involve a felony, and so did not require the more sweeping approach to win the case. The Supreme Court had held that the Sixth Amendment's jury trial guarantee for federal defendants in all criminal prosecutions did not apply to petty offenses. The same line might be drawn in state cases under the 14th Amendment. Another practical question was at what stage of the criminal case a lawyer should be supplied. Some authorities felt, and Fortas agreed, that a man needs a lawyer immediately after arrest more acutely than he does later. But the police were strongly against that idea, reasoning that early access to lawyers would discourage prisoners from confessing, and in 1958 the Supreme Court had rejected the claim of a man with adequate funds that he should have been allowed to call in his own lawyer before being questioned by the police. Gideon had sought a lawyer only at trial, and so Fortas need not go back beyond that point. It would be foolhardy to claim any greater right for the poor man than one with funds had been able to establish. The remaining, and even more important, practical consequence to weigh was the effect of a victory for Gideon on other prisoners who had been tried without counsel. The forecast that an absolute counsel requirement would lead to wholesale emptying of prisons was perhaps the most powerful emotional argument against overruling Betts v. Brady, and it was a factor that had been mentioned in opinions since Betts. One way to avoid that consequence would be to apply a new absolute counsel rule only prospectively. For example, the court could affirm Gideon's conviction, applying to him the established Betts doctrine, but warn that all convictions would be set aside in future unless the states provided counsel. Some state courts have done exactly that when they have overruled earlier doctrines, and the Supreme Court has said there is nothing unconstitutional about this procedure of prospective overruling. In Griffin v. Illinois, when the court opened up a new avenue for appeals by saying the states could not deny prisoners the right because of their inability to buy a trial transcript, Justice Frankfurter had been concerned about the effect on cases long since concluded and had suggested applying the new doctrine only to the future. But that proposal was rejected in Griffin, and in fact the Supreme Court had never itself used the process of prospective overruling. The Griffin case was subsequently applied to make the states grant appeals to men who had been in prison 20 years. Crash pointed out that anyone whose conviction was voided as a result of a reinterpretation of the Constitution could be retried. He might even end up with a more severe sentence. One man serving a life sentence in a federal penitentiary had won a new trial when, in 1938, the Supreme Court first imposed an absolute counsel requirement for federal cases. At the new trial, he was convicted again and sentenced to death. The sentence was commuted. The consequences of overruling Betts v. Brady would also be mitigated by the fact that so many states now provided counsel for the poor in their criminal courts. Exactly what had happened in the states was not clear. No one had done a thorough job of research and compilation until Professor Yale Kamisar of the University of Minnesota Law School published a definitive article in the autumn 1962 issue of the University of Chicago Law Review. The article would have been too late for use in Fortas's brief, but Professor Kamisar, knowing about the Gideon case, had telephoned Crash in September and offered to send him a copy of the manuscript. The offer was gladly accepted. Professor Kamisar showed that at the time of Betts v. Brady, 30 states provided counsel as a matter of right in all felony cases. Now 37 did so. That left 13 with no statewide formal requirement for provision of counsel except in death cases. But Kamisar had discovered, by corresponding with prosecutors, judges, and other authorities in these states, that in 8 of the 13, the practice of appointing counsel had developed without benefit of any statute or rule of court. At least in the larger cities in those 8 states, indigent defendants charged with felonies were likely to be given lawyers, although there was no guarantee, and the chances were not so good for rural defendants. In Baltimore, for example, counsel was usually provided for any indigent requesting assistance in the criminal courts, although Maryland still held officially to the Betts rule that it had spawned, and defendants outside of Baltimore probably had to demonstrate special circumstances to get a lawyer. In Philadelphia, a private defender association made up for the deficiencies of the most populous state still not committed as a matter of policy to provide counsel for all indigent felony defendants. With those 8 states added to the 37, there were left only 5 that did not assure counsel for the poor except in capital cases: Alabama, Florida, Mississippi, North Carolina, and South Carolina. Even in Florida, 3 cities, Miami, Tampa, and Fort Lauderdale, had local public defenders. And Professor Kamisar showed that 24 states, nearly half, went beyond the line of felonies and provided counsel for misdemeanor defendants. Eli had written a draft brief before returning to Yale. Crash and Fortas liked it, but they wanted something more finished and more pointed. Crash put the brief through another draft, reshaping it from a scholarly examination of the problems into more of a piece of advocacy designed to persuade. Fortas soaked himself in the right to counsel issue by sitting in the firm library for a week reading cases and commentary, an unusual expenditure of time for a senior partner in a large, busy law firm. Then, one weekend, on his way to join his wife in Westport, Connecticut, Fortas stopped at the Hotel Biltmore in New York and sat in a room for 2 days, blocking out the brief he wanted. From these notes on Biltmore stationery, and after a day's discussion with Fortas, Crash did a fresh draft. Subject to smoothing and tinkering, it was the final product. But this bare outline of how the brief was completed does not adequately convey the amount of work done. Crash's office diary shows that in the month from the printing of the record to the filing of the brief, he spent an average of 6 hours every working day on the case of Clarence Earl Gideon. The brief was filed on November 21st. It was 53 pages long, packing into that limited space many of the arguments suggested in the memoranda circulated at Arnold Fortas and Porter in the previous months, but putting them less discursively, more pointedly, and as part of a literate whole. The brief did not mention the old controversy about incorporation of the Bill of Rights into the 14th Amendment. It assumed the continuing vitality of the Cardozo Doctrine that fundamental rights were absorbed into the Due Process Clause. Nor was there any attempt to bring Gideon within the Special Circumstances Rule by showing that he suffered from any particular disability or prejudice at his trial. The brief was a frontal assault on Betts v. Brady. In an introductory section, Fortas said the experience of administering the Betts Rule over 20 years had not been a happy one. The quality of criminal justice and the relations between the federal and state courts have suffered. On one side, the doctrine of limiting counsel to those cases where special need could be shown had not assured and cannot be expected to assure that counsel will be provided where necessary in the interests of fundamental fairness. On the other, the Betts Rule had turned out not to be an appropriate adaptation of the 14th Amendment to the demands of federalism. To the contrary, it is a rule which compels continual, unseemly, and improper intervention by the federal courts in state criminal proceedings, not on the basis of applying a concrete fundamental principle, but by the corrosive and irritating process of case-by-case review. Betts v. Brady has not meant and will not mean less federal intervention in state criminal proceedings than would be the case if the 14th Amendment were construed to require that counsel be furnished in all state criminal prosecutions. Because of the intensely factual, subjective, and post-facto nature of its standards, Betts v. Brady means more federal intervention on a case-by-case basis, and in a much more exacerbating form. In a separate appendix in the brief, Gideon's trial was analyzed to show how a lawyer would have protected Gideon. The analysis vividly demonstrates, Fortas said, that he did not have a fair trial in the constitutional sense, but it is our opinion that these points of analysis are not peculiar to Gideon's case. We believe they are present in every criminal prosecution. That introduction conveyed the essence of what Fortas felt about the case. The brief proper was in 5 sections, with numerous subsections. These were the 5 headings, and, in briefest summary, the points made under each. 1. The 14th Amendment requires that counsel be appointed to represent an indigent defendant in every criminal case involving a serious offense. First, the aid of counsel is indispensable to a fair hearing. Even a trained criminal lawyer will not undertake his own defense. Many constitutional rights, such as the new protection against use of illegally seized evidence, are meaningless in the absence of counsel. Second, the absolute requirement of counsel in federal prosecutions confirms the need. Third, reliance on the trial judge to assert the defendant's rights is misplaced, because a man cannot be both judge and counsel. Fourth, the distinction between capital and non-capital cases is invalid as a basis for determining the constitutional right to counsel. The Due Process Clause protects one's liberty and property, as well as one's life. Moreover, the need for counsel is greater in some non-capital crimes. The court rejected the capital-non-capital distinction in the overseas court-martial cases because of their importance, Fortas thus rejecting Eli's advice to play them down. They are discussed in a separate appendix. Fifth, the Equal Protection Clause requires provision of counsel, citing Griffin v. Illinois. 2. The demands of federalism do not dictate continued adherence to Betts v. Brady. The need for counsel is so obvious that the real argument for Betts v. Brady must be federalism. But it is a false argument. First, relying on Professor Commissar's article, the vast majority of the states now appoint counsel in all felony cases as a rule or a matter of practice. This removes the factual premise of Justice Roberts' opinion in Betts that the state's considered judgment was not to regard counsel as a fundamental right essential to a fair trial. In 1961, when the court in Mapp v. Ohio imposed the exclusionary search and seizure rule on the states, only half of them had taken that step themselves. Second, Betts v. Brady has created friction between the states and the federal courts, because it does not prescribe a clear-cut standard which the state courts can follow. The rule of special circumstances involves federal supervision over the state courts in its most noxious form. In effect, the federal courts are given a roving commission to scrutinize the proceeding in the state court to see if it is shocking to the universal sense of justice. A flood of habeas corpus petitions has been spawned, leading to agitation to curtail the great writ of habeas corpus. Third, an absolute counsel requirement would still leave ample room for state experimentation, a benefit of our federal system. States would try different systems for providing counsel, public defenders, private voluntary associations, assigning counsel. 3. The rule of Betts v. Brady has not proved to be a satisfactory standard for judicial administration. First, the Supreme Court's own decisions under the special circumstances approach have been confusing and inconsistent, quoting Professor Allen. Second, the rule has only infrequently led the state courts to appoint counsel. Some of the state decisions are startling. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court, for example, denied relief to a prisoner convicted without counsel at the age of 18, although it recognized that he was not wholly a normal person. A behavior clinic study of the defendant shortly before his arrest revealed him to be a high-grade moron with an intelligence quotient of 59. Equivalent to a mental age of only 9. Third, the special circumstances rule is inherently unfair in operation because it usually requires an ignorant layman to prepare, without a lawyer's help, the necessary subtle argument on appeal that the circumstances at his trial required counsel. Fourth, the rule is also unfair because many years may elapse between conviction and the finding of special circumstances. Fifth, delay is undesirable for the states, too, since witnesses may have died and records been lost, so that new trials cannot be held. 4. The right to counsel minimally includes appointment of an attorney to assist an indigent person at the trial of a serious offense. It is not necessary now to delineate all of the meets and bounds of the right to counsel in state criminal proceedings. An accused should have the right to consult a lawyer at any time immediately after arrest, but this case involves only the trial stage of the prosecution. Whatever the perimeter of the right, it surely comprehends the assignment of counsel at the trial. As for the kind of crimes reached, it may be noted that the court has limited the right of trial by jury in federal cases to exclude petty offenses. 5. The practical implications with respect to persons already imprisoned do not militate against overruling Betts v. Brady. A word should be said about the contention that the rule should not be changed because it may result in releasing indeterminate numbers of prisoners in some states. First, anyone whose conviction is reversed is always subject to retrial. Second, the court rejected similar counsels of fear when it decided the Griffin and Mapp cases, changing constitutional doctrine on rights of appeal and excludable evidence. The constitutional claim here is even stronger, and the states have had ample notice of the importance of counsel to a defendant's rights, 30 years since the Scottsboro case, Powell v. Alabama. At the end, Fortas quoted from the letter written to the New York Times by Irwin Griswold and Benjamin Cohen after the Betts decision. At a critical period in world history, Betts v. Brady tilts the scales against the safeguarding of one of the most precious rights of man. For in a free world, no man should be condemned to penal servitude for years without having the right to counsel to defend him. The right of counsel, for the poor as well as the rich, is an indispensable safeguard of freedom and justice under law. Then, in the customarily flat, unemotional finale, the brief concluded, "For the reasons stated, Betts v. Brady should be overruled, and the judgment of the court below should be reversed." It was signed by Fortas, Crash, and Temple, and a footnote acknowledged the valuable assistance of one who could not sign because he was not a member of the bar, John Hart Eli, a third-year student at the Yale Law School, New Haven, Connecticut. Fortas mailed the brief, as required, to the opposing counsel, the Florida Attorney General's office. He also sent a copy to Gideon at the state prison in Rayford, Florida. Gideon replied on November 30th as follows. "Dear Sir, this is to thank you for sending me a copy of the brief you have prepared and presented to the Supreme Court for my cause. Everyone and myself thinks it is a very wonderful and brilliant document. I do not know how you have enticed the general public to take such an interest in this cause, but I must say it makes me feel very good. Sincerely yours, Clarence Earl Gideon." Chapter 10. In the ordinary criminal case, the advantage is overwhelmingly with the state, which has abundant resources of men and money to bring against the friendless defendant. Certainly that had been true at the trial of Clarence Earl Gideon. But now, in the Supreme Court, the odds were reversed. A large and expert law firm had done many thousands of dollars' worth of legal work on Gideon's behalf, and he had in his favor also the momentum of legal history, the trend of decisions pointing toward the overruling of Betts v. Brady. On the other side, defending that much-criticized decision and seeking to keep Gideon in prison, there was a single young and inexperienced lawyer who before this case had never set foot in the Supreme Court of the United States. He was Bruce Robert Jacob, an assistant attorney general of Florida, 26 years old when Gideon v. Cochran began its way through the Supreme Court. The attorney general of Florida, Richard W. Irvin, had formal charge of representing the state's interest in the case, but in fact Jacob wrote most of the legal papers, made the argument, and bore the responsibility for the case from beginning to end. Bruce Jacob is a tall, blonde, serious-looking young man whose life reached all sorts of turning points during the year of the Gideon case. In addition to the case itself, and not many lawyers make Supreme Court arguments at that age, Jacob went into private practice while he was writing the brief, won a commission as a second lieutenant in the National Guard, and was married. It was a busy year. Jacob was born March 26, 1935, in Chicago, and his family moved to Sarasota, Florida, when he was a junior in high school. They sent him back to Principia College, a Christian Science institution in Elsa, Illinois, but he quit after a year. He finished college at Florida State University in Tallahassee and got his law degree at Stetson Law School in St. Petersburg. After a few months in a law office in Sarasota and 6 months in the Army, Jacob joined the state attorney general's office and went into the criminal division. When the Gideon case came along, he had been there 2 years and had argued several criminal cases in the state courts. He was hoping that the assistant attorney general in charge of criminal appeals, Reeves Bowen, would let him argue a case in the Supreme Court of the United States. The first Jacob heard of the Gideon case was when the Supreme Court, in March 1962, asked the Florida Attorney General's office to respond to Gideon's petition for review. Reeves Bowen gave Jacob the case. He worked alone on the response to Gideon's petition, relying on Betts and some of its successor cases, not because he was unaware of their shaky status, but because he hoped the court would not choose Gideon's case as the vehicle for overruling. He was courting a girl who worked in the same building, and after hours she typed the response for him. He learned in June that the court had granted the petition when he read a newspaper story about the case. The formal letter from the clerk's office arrived a few days later. Jacob was due to spend 2 weeks in June at a National Guard officer's candidate school, but before leaving, he talked with one of the more experienced men in the office, George Georgiev, about what might be done. Georgiev suggested writing to the other 49 states and asking them to file amicus curiae, friend of the court briefs, with the aim of mustering a demonstration of sentiment in behalf of Florida and Betts v. Brady. Jacob thought writing the states was a good idea for another reason, so that if Betts v. Brady was overruled, they couldn't come back and say, "What the heck? Why didn't you tell us about it?" That thought was in his mind because of what he was told by a colleague in the office who had argued and lost another recent right-to-counsel case in the Supreme Court. Sometime later, this man said, he was with a group of lawyers and was called a son of a bitch by some other state official for losing the case. Jacob was never sure whether this really happened or was made up to tease him. "Every day in the Attorney General's office," Jacob said later, "we'd sit around drinking coffee, and they'd kid me and say I'd better be anonymous after this case was decided. I'd better go somewhere and hide. If you get called that for losing a case on special circumstances, think what they'd do to me for losing Betts v. Brady. There were a lot of people who didn't want that case overruled." The night before he left for National Guard camp, Jacob drafted a letter to the attorneys general of the other states. Attorney General Irvin approved it and had the 49 copies sent out over his, Irvin's, signature. It read as follows. "Dear General, enclosed is a photostatic copy of a letter received by me from the United States Supreme Court stating that certiorari has been granted in the case of Gideon v. Cochran and advising that the court desires briefs on the question of whether the holding of Betts v. Brady, 316 U.S. 455, should be reconsidered. Four members of the present court have expressed the view, at one time or another, that Betts should be overruled and that the concept of the right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment should be embraced within the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. If the minority can obtain one more vote, Betts will be overruled, and the states will, in effect, be mandatorily required to appoint counsel in all felony cases. Such a decision would infringe on the right of the states to determine their own rules of criminal procedure. Because of the importance of the question, I am hereby inviting the attorneys general of all states to submit amicus briefs in the Gideon case. Also, I would appreciate any advice or aid you can offer, including any statistics or information which you believe would be helpful to us in preparing the main brief." The role of the amicus curiae is well established in the Supreme Court, curious as that might seem in a legal system generally devoted to the thesis that only those personally affected may take their complaint to a court. The amicus is, by definition, a person or institution not personally involved in the particular lawsuit. The amicus may be interested because the court's resolution of the legal issue in a case may someday have an effect on him or it. That was the case when other southern states came in as friends of the court in the school segregation cases, to help those states defending the particular lawsuits. Or an amicus may be an organization with a worthy social aim to push. That was the case of the 21 racial, religious, and civil liberties groups that joined in asking the court to outlaw restrictive real estate covenants in 1948. The federal government very often comes into Supreme Court cases as a friend of the court. It has done so in virtually every major test of race relations law in recent years. There is disagreement about the exact function of the amicus curiae. In theory, he is supposed to shed some light on a case that the actual parties are not able or willing to provide. One reason for the Supreme Court's frequent invitation to the federal government to participate in non-government cases is that the Solicitor General, the Justice Department lawyer who officially represents the government before the court, provides a degree of expertise and responsibility and advocacy that few private counsel can match. One of the deficiencies of the Supreme Court process is that it often depends on the presentations of inadequate counsel, and the amicus, who, like the Solicitor General, has a continuing awareness of the court's needs, can be helpful. Private groups can perform a service in that respect along with the Solicitor General. The decision in Mapp v. Ohio, outlawing the use of illegally seized evidence in state criminal trials, followed an argument in which counsel for Miss Mapp did not raise that constitutional question at all. But a lawyer for the Ohio Civil Liberties Union, appearing as a friend of the court, did make the point, and the court seized on it. More often, amicus curiae briefs do not really offer anything new or helpful to the court. They are filed by interested groups or institutions to let the court know where they stand, a kind of raw tally of public pressures. Most of the 21 amicus briefs in the restrictive covenant cases were in that category, documents designed to register each group's view and make it feel important, not to provide distinct legal theories. The next year, the court, perhaps suffering from the volume of its friends, changed its rules to limit the filing of amicus briefs. The general rule now is that one may be filed only with the consent of all the parties to a case, or by order of the court upon a showing of facts or questions of law that have not been, or reasons for believing that they will not adequately be, presented by the parties. But the rule does not apply to the federal government or to the states, which may enter any case as a friend of the court. What Florida was setting out to do with the other states was not at all unusual. State attorneys general frequently file amicus briefs in the Supreme Court, and almost without exception, the purpose of those briefs is to oppose federal restraints on state processes. When the Supreme Court was considering the New York Regent's Prayer, the term before the Gideon case, 22 states joined as friends of the court, asking that New York be allowed to continue the prayer ceremony. Irvin's letter made the traditional appeal to the states as states, asking them to help resist another infringement on the right of the states to determine their own rules of criminal procedure. Anyone would have expected a substantial show of support for Florida in amicus curiae briefs from the states. But the actual result of Jacob's letter was astonishingly different. Only about half of the attorneys general replied at all, and even those who were sympathetic were not too helpful. Charles J. Adams of Vermont wrote, "My personal views are that individual states should take a position which would be in opposition to the overruling of Betts v. Brady, although with cases along the lines of Mapp v. Ohio, there seems to be less and less room for a state to establish and maintain its own procedure in criminal matters. As regards our preparing and filing a brief amicus curiae, I doubt very much that we would be able to do so due to the lack of sufficient staff for that purpose, but I might be interested in joining with some other state in its brief." Edwin K. Steers of Indiana wrote that he was "sympathetic with your cause and agree that the steady trend of the recent decisions in the Supreme Court of the United States is infringing on state criminal procedure. But he said Indiana had always provided counsel for the indigent right up through their appeals, so he would have to say no to filing a brief amicus. Similarly, William M. Ferguson of Kansas said a law on that state's book since 1941 guaranteed counsel in every criminal case, so that Kansas could not help. "You have, however, on the basic philosophical issue of states' rights, my wholehearted moral support." The Deputy Attorney General of Pennsylvania, Frank P. Lawley, Jr., said that state was seriously considering the possibility of filing a brief amicus. "You indicate that in your judgment, if Betts is overruled, the states would be required to appoint counsel in all felony cases. What worries me most is the possibility that the Supreme Court, if it did overrule Betts, would not limit such requirement to felony cases." In mid-August, 2 months after Jacob's letter went out, a reply of a quite different kind came in from the Attorney General of Minnesota, Walter F. Mondale. "I believe in federalism and states' rights, too," he wrote, "but I also believe in the Bill of Rights. Nobody knows better than an attorney general or a prosecuting attorney that in this day and age, furnishing an attorney to those felony defendants who can't afford to hire one is fair and feasible. Nobody knows better than we do that rules of criminal law and procedure which baffle trained professionals can only overwhelm the uninitiated. As chief law enforcement officer of one of the 35 states which provide for the appointment of counsel for indigents in all felony cases, I am convinced that it is cheap, very cheap, at the price. I can assure you that such a requirement does not disrupt or otherwise adversely affect our work. Since I firmly believe that any person charged with a felony should be accorded a right to be represented by counsel regardless of his financial condition, I would welcome the court's imposition of a requirement of appointment of counsel in all state felony prosecutions." The Mondale letter irritated Jacob. "I thought everyone should have a lawyer. We all thought that," he said later. "But I thought the states should do it by themselves, not have it imposed on them by constitutional construction." Jacob felt so strongly that he wrote a reply for Attorney General Urban. "I am compelled to answer," the letter said, "because I feel that you do not fully understand my position. I have been placed in the position of an advocate, and as I see it, my duty is to present to the Supreme Court the strongest possible argument on why the doctrine of Betts v. Brady should be adhered to. My personal feelings on whether Betts is a good rule or not are of no consequence." There were two reasons for suggesting participation by the other states, the letter said. Some of them might prefer to make their own decision on providing counsel for all felony defendants, and absorption of the Sixth Amendment's counsel guarantee into the 14th Amendment might well mean a requirement of lawyers in misdemeanor cases, where fewer than half the states now provided them. Mondale sent a conciliatory reply, saying, "I truly understand and respect your position as an advocate," but he reaffirmed his feeling about the issue. So far as Jacob was concerned, that ended the episode. But unknown to him, Attorney General Mondale's interest in the Gideon case was not over. He sent copies of his correspondence to several persons, among them the Attorney General of Massachusetts, Edward J. McCormick, Jr. At the time, McCormick was known to the public as the man making a race, futile as it turned out, against Edward M. Kennedy for the Democratic senatorial nomination. Among law officers, he was known particularly for the active division of civil rights and civil liberties he had set up in his office. He passed the Mondale correspondence on to the chief of that division, Assistant Attorney General Gerald A. Berlin. Shortly before Labor Day, Berlin, who was vacationing on Martha's Vineyard, mentioned the Urban-Mondale exchange of letters to some friends over cocktails. As they discussed it, Berlin thought of the possibility of writing an amicus brief on the other side of the case, in behalf of Gideon. When he got back to the office, he readily got McCormick's approval of the idea. He talked to Professor Clark Bice of the Harvard Law School, faculty advisor to a student organization called the Civil Liberties Research Service, and arranged for it to provide some material. The students were helpful, although the deadline was so close that Berlin had to do more brief writing than he had expected. Three other members of the Harvard Law faculty helped out, Professor Mark DeWolf Howe on one section of the brief, and Professors Howe and Roger Fisher and Dean Irwin N. Griswold in checking Berlin's draft. The Massachusetts brief writing project was cleared with Mondale, who had wanted to do the same thing but had not got around to it. Mondale helped persuade other attorneys general to sign, and at the last minute, McCormick and Berlin got on the telephone and signed up more states. The brief was filed on November 23rd. The Supreme Court rules require amici curiae to file by the same date as the party they are supporting, with the endorsement of 22 states, in this listed order: Massachusetts, Minnesota, Colorado, Connecticut, Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho, Illinois, Iowa, Kentucky, Maine, Michigan, Missouri, Nevada, Ohio, North Dakota, Oregon, Rhode Island, South Dakota, Washington, West Virginia, Alaska. It turned out later that New Jersey had agreed to sign, but had inadvertently been omitted. The correction was made just in time to be reflected in the United States reports, the permanent bound volumes of Supreme Court opinions. Among the unusual aspects of this brief for 23 states was the fact that three of the signers, Hawaii, Maine, and Rhode Island, had no general requirement for appointment of counsel in felony cases. The mere fact that 23 states would urge the Supreme Court to impose a new standard of fairness on state criminal procedure was the most startling of all. Indeed, when one member of the Supreme Court saw this amicus brief, he remarked that he would not have been surprised had the court instead received one from 49 states endorsing Florida's position. The brief for the 23 states called forthrightly for the overruling of Betts v. Brady, making many of the same arguments as Fortas. The two briefs were prepared without consultation or even knowledge of each other's intentions. Fortas was as astounded as the justices when he got a copy of it. Berlin called the special circumstances rule a curious doctrine, and said the court had persistently whittled away at it in cases after Betts. Even when the rule had been applied, he said, it was with reluctance and usually by a closely and sharply divided court. It is now most unrealistic to expect that the trial judges, looking ahead, can accomplish that which has obviously been so disturbing to this court from the vantage point of looking back. The distinctive section of Berlin's brief for the states dealt with the practical results of overruling Betts v. Brady. The brief was carefully confined to advocating provision of counsel in felony cases, but it admitted that misdemeanors might be foreseen as the troublesome next step. It said also that the question of adequacy of representation will someday present a problem to this court, and that representation alone does not solve the problems of the indigent accused, for there may be other vital expenses, such as the traveling expenses, daily fees, and subsistence of witnesses. Then the brief faced the problem posed by those already in prison, who might seek their release if Betts v. Brady were abandoned. One course, it said, would be to let all these prisoners come under the new decision. That was the practice followed after the Supreme Court in 1938 established an absolute right to counsel in federal criminal trials. However onerous the task of dealing with prisoners' pleas, the court managed to dispose of them, convinced, evidently, that it was wiser to make the new constitutional guarantee fully effective than to protect themselves from a flood of cases. But there was an alternative, which in many ways seems more desirable. That is for this court to determine that, since the standards which it establishes are dependent not upon the specific intention of the framers of the Constitution, but upon the lessons of experience, it is appropriate not to give those standards retroactive effect. Thus, on this point, the state's brief was in direct conflict with Fortas's view that prospective overruling, applying the new right to counsel only in future, was an inappropriate course for the Supreme Court. This section on practical problems ended with a statement that all branches of the legal profession would have to bestir themselves to meet the need for counsel if Betts were overruled. State and local bar associations, charitable organizations, law schools, individual members of the bar by appointment. Then the brief concluded. Betts v. Brady, already an anachronism when handed down, has spawned 20 years of bad law. That in the world of today a man may be condemned to penal servitude for lack of means to supply counsel for his defense is unthinkable. We respectfully urge that the conviction below be reversed, that Betts v. Brady be reconsidered, and that this court require that all persons tried for a felony in a state court shall have the right to counsel as a matter of due process of law and of equal protection of the laws. Jacob had no idea that any states were planning an amicus brief on the other side. The first he heard of it was just before the brief was filed in late November. The Attorney General of Missouri, Thomas F. Eagleton, mentioned the Massachusetts brief in a letter to Richard Irvin, adding that, to be abundantly frank, he intended to join it. Jacob was surprised, but he felt he had done the right thing in calling the attention of the other state law officers to the Gideon case. He thought, as he had originally, that they were entitled to know about an issue so important for the state criminal process, even though it had turned out that so many of them were on the other side of the issue. One more state amicus brief came in without notice to Jacob or Fortas. It was from Oregon, and it dealt entirely with Oregon's experience under a 1959 state law allowing prisoners to petition the courts for relief of claimed violations of their federal constitutional rights, including violations long ago at their trials. Since the passage of the act, the Oregon brief said, the courts had ruled in favor of 20 prisoners, finding substantial defects in their convictions or sentences. Of those, 15 had had no lawyers when the defect occurred. 8 prisoners had won their final release from prison under the act. All had lacked counsel at the crucial point in the original proceeding. The brief was only 6 pages long, but it made a single point tellingly. This was, as expressed in the conclusion, the experience of the state of Oregon tends to indicate that it would provide greater protection of constitutional rights and would be less expensive to insist upon counsel in each original criminal proceeding than to attempt by a post-conviction proceeding to recover justice lost by defects at the trial. Florida had also given permission to the American Civil Liberties Union to come in as a friend of the court. Its concern with the case had begun with a telephone call from J. Lee Rankin, the last Solicitor General in the Eisenhower administration, who had gone to New York to practice. Rankin had a deep interest in civil liberties and was a member of the advisory committee of the Civil Liberties Center at the New York University Law School. When he read about the Supreme Court's grant of certiorari in the Gideon case and its call for a reappraisal of Betts v. Brady, he telephoned the director of the center, Associate Professor Norman Dorson, and asked whether any civil liberties group planned to participate. Dorson carried the idea to Melvin L. Wolf, legal director of the ACLU, who thought an amicus brief was desirable. These 3 men took principal responsibility for the ACLU presentation, with Rankin as the senior attorney, Dorson in charge of the brief drafting, and Wolf doing particular research. A distinctive contribution of the Civil Liberties Union brief was an exhaustive survey of the handling of right-to-counsel cases by the state courts under the Special Circumstances Doctrine of Betts v. Brady. The survey, which covered all the reported decisions by appellate courts in states without an automatic counsel rule, showed that those courts very rarely found special circumstances requiring a lawyer. Of 44 cases in Pennsylvania, only 1 had been adjudged to present such circumstances. 3 were remanded for a lower court hearing. In Maryland, 3 of 38 cases were deemed to show the need for a lawyer. In Florida, 1 of 17, and 1 remanded for a hearing. Altogether, of 139 state appellate court decisions on the special circumstances issue, only 11 found that the trial judge had erred in failing to appoint counsel. After losing in the state courts, the ACLU brief said, the prisoner probably asks the Supreme Court for review, which is usually denied, often because there was no hearing granted in the state courts that would have revealed the possible validity of a constitutional claim. Then the prisoner can go to a federal district court with a petition for habeas corpus and go through a whole new round, the district court, a court of appeals, and then the Supreme Court. All this, said the ACLU brief, expended large and increasing amounts of judicial energy. The number of habeas corpus petitions filed in the federal district courts had gone up from 127